This Sunday, February 19th, will mark the 70th anniversary of a unique American document with a dark history. It was Executive Order 9066, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed it just a few months after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. That simple pen stroke sent 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry, most of them U.S. citizens, into war relocation camps. Most of these camps were in remote desert areas where the Japanese lived in barracks behind barbed wire. The closest camp to us was Manzanar, at the base of the Sierra Nevada, on the other side of Death Valley. They stayed in these camps from 1942 to 1946. That period was known as the Lost Years, and historians have called it America's worst wartime mistake. President Ford later revoked FDR's order, and in 1989, President George H.W. Bush issued redress payments and an official apology, even though many Japanese had already lost their homes, businesses, and farms while they were interned. Today, as we approach the 70th anniversary of that internment order, we'll talk to two women who lived in the camps. We'll also talk with an expert on Manzanar, which has become a national historic site. And we'll talk to a Japanese American who fought for the U.S. even while his fellow citizens were being interned by the same government. I'd like to start with two women who were interned during the war. Rosie Kakuuchi was 16 when she and her family went to Manzanar, and she joins us in studio now. Rosie, great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also joining us is Taiko Joanne Iritani. She was 12 when she and her family went to Poston Camp in Arizona. In 1989, she and her husband visited all 10 internment camps, and they wrote a book called 10 Visits. She joins us on the line from her home in Sacramento. Taiko, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Rosie, I'd like to start with you. You were 16 and living in Los Angeles when the war broke out. Then one day your uncle comes and tells everyone, pack your things. Were you aware of what was going on?
To be honest with you, we were all very, really, really confused. But my uncle gets news from other places, and he says, I want my family all together. So there were about one, two, three, four of family. It's a clan. There must have been about 24 of us. And he says, we're going to all leave together. So we're going to all gather, and we gathered in one area in Los Angeles. And when we got our orders to leave, he says, okay, we're all going to go. I'm trying to think, how did we get to the Union Station, which was close? Maybe we walked it. I don't know, because we only had two luggages. And he just made sure we got on the train, the same train. So he just blocked everyone else, and that's how we all left it together.
When this was happening, did you think that you were ever going to go back home or that this was going to be permanent?
We had no idea where we were going. We had no idea what was going to happen. I think we just, whatever they told us to do, we just followed instructions just like a puppet and just did what they told us to do.
When you arrived at Manzanar camp, what was that moment like? What did you see and what were you feeling?
Horrible. Just, today it's nice because they're fixing it up, but at that time it was barren. Some of the barracks were up, some were still being constructed. I can't remember if the dust was there, but all I know is it was a horrible feeling because you see all our Japanese, they're all Japanese, and they're all looking at us because they don't know who we were, and they look kind of worn out and dusty and dark. And so, as I said before, we must have looked just like that when we met all the buses coming in to see if any of our friends were there. But it was just out of nowhere, here's these barracks and barbed wire fences and sentry towers just around there.
Let me turn over to Taiko Iritani. Taiko, your family was sent to a different camp.
Yes.
It was called Poston in Arizona, and you were 12 at the time. Do you remember what the camp looked like when you arrived?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to start with before we went to the camp. I lived in Bakersfield, and we had our little Japanese Methodist church, and my Sunday school teacher was a Caucasian lady who was a first grade teacher, and she and the ministers of the two Methodist churches formed a group called the Aid to Japanese Methodist Evacuation Committee. And they assisted us because we all knew that it was going to occur. All the people on the coastal region had been moved into assembly centers and so on. So we knew it was coming. And because of this committee, there was someone to take care of the things that were stored in our Methodist church and in the Buddhist people's things in the Buddhist church. And Emma Buckmaster, my Sunday school teacher, wrote to everybody, children like us, the adults, and including every single Nisei soldier in Bakersfield, who had, some had been fighting with the 100th Battalion even, in North Africa. So, we had some assistance that way, but of course, there was no question that we were all going to go. And, we took the train from the Santa Fe Depot. And, you know, I don't remember soldiers with bayonets, but I've seen pictures of those at some of these places where the people had to gather.
Okay.
And, of course, got to Poston, and all you could see was barrack after barrack after barrack. And it was Indian reservation land. So, of course, during the years... hot, hot, hot summers. And, well, one thing, too, I remember, the first thing we were assigned to do was to take these long white bags and fill them with straw. And that was my mattress for a while until they got the regular mattresses. And a few years ago, we were told that those were actually body bags, which really doesn't surprise anyone, does it?
Tycho, I just wanted to clarify that when you say body bags, those were mattress covers that were used during the war as body bags, not actual official body bags.
Yeah. Well, that's what was available to the Army after all. But, yes, that's what I've been told, that those long white bags were.
Tycho, you were 12 years old at the time. Were you aware of what was happening, and were you scared?
Not really. You know, with all that we read and heard about, that's the only thing you could do is do whatever Mom told you to do. Because after all of us who are surviving that time, we were all children at that time. Even my eldest brother was only 16. So you just follow the direction of the parents.
And what about your parents? Do you remember what your parents' mood was like and how they dealt with it?
My father was a farmer in on the east side of Bakersfield. And he rented 40 acres of land. You see, he was from Japan, so he could not become an American citizen, which means he also could not either purchase land or to lease land in his own name. He had to rent month by month. And so for our family, when we did finally come back in 45, we had no home to come back to. My father had to get rid of all the farm equipment, all of our larger furniture, all of the animals we had. We had chickens and ducks and pigeons and dog and cat and even a nanny goat that a shepherd gave us. So while we were at school, my father took care of everything. We didn't know what he had been doing.
And so you lost all of that.
Of course.
Tycho, were your parents resentful about that?
Not at all. I'm sure you're not aware of what we do here in Sacramento, but our Flora and JACL over the years have done oral histories. And we have many stories by not just the Issei, but also of the Nisei and the community people and teachers who were teachers within some campsites. And I find very little bitterness in the stories they relate. And I think that's good, because bitterness hurts only yourself.
And you had mentioned the JACL, and was it JALC?
Just outside of Sacramento is a little town called Florin, and these people, that community disappeared once all the Japanese left.
Okay, and you mentioned the Japanese American Citizens League, that is the JACL.
Right.
And also when you mentioned Nisei, we have to mention that's second generation. I'd like to bring in someone who's very familiar with the setup of these war relocation camps. Alisa Lynch is the chief of interpretation out at the Manzanar War Relocation Camp, which is now a National Historic Site run by the National Park Service. Alisa, what were general living conditions at camps like Manzanar?
Well, when people first arrived, they were still in the process of building the camp. The Army started building the camp in March, and the first people arrived April 1st. So there were people coming in as they were literally building barracks. They hired a company called Griffith, Griffith and Sons, I believe, from Los Angeles, and they brought up 600 workmen to basically erect the camp as quickly as possible. And as they did, people were continuing to pour in. And so the conditions, especially early on, were very primitive because you had people who were moving into barracks, in some cases, that didn't have windows, didn't have roofs. You had latrines that still had open sewage ditches. You know, some of the first meals were prepared just out of Army canned goods. And things did change over time, but I think people definitely remember how rough it was when they first came in. Not that it ever got easy, but things did improve, you know, as they finished up the barracks. A lot of people, we've reconstructed a couple barracks here, and people see the early barracks, which is just bare wood, bare floors, and that's what a lot of folks remember as their barracks being, although there are documents that talk about how they've, you know, laid down all of this linoleum, put up wallboard and other things in late 1942, which would have been, you know, an improvement physically in what people had. But I think that those early days definitely stick in people's minds.
Yeah, and you talk about some of those the shocking conditions, especially early on. There were 146 prisoners who died at Manzanar, and 15 were buried there. What did they die from?
Oh, it was actually 150. A lot of them died from natural causes. We have some people who died in childbirth. In fact, Rosie's sister and two nieces died in the hospital when her sister was giving birth to these twin girls. You had two people who died here having been shot by military police during an incident that was called the Manzanar Riot. But other than that, you have a lot of things of people having ulcers, cancer, heart attacks. It was, you know, pretty reflective of populations in terms of what people died of at that time.
And you, by the way, you mentioned a riot?
Well, it's called the Manzanar Riot. I think whether or not people agree that it is a riot, it was a group of people who gathered together to protest the jailing of another former internee named Harry Ueno. And he had been suspected of beating another guy who was actually a representative of the Japanese American Citizens League, the group that Tycho was talking about. Anyway, it's a very long, convoluted story, but the bottom line is that the military police fired into a crowd. One young man, Jimmy Ito, was killed instantly. Another guy, James Kanagawa, died a couple days later.
You know, you mentioned, too, by the way, how some of the people had died, and you mentioned Rosie, and Rosie wanted to come back to you. You lost your sister at the camp, and she died trying to give birth to twins. do you blame the camp situation and the circumstances for what happened?
Well, you know that the hospital was very inadequate as far as the equipment and everything. And at the other interview, I mentioned that my mother was very bitter because this Ruby was her oldest daughter, and she was happy. Finally, she's going to be a grandmother. And my sister was a very quiet, beautiful, young, only 23 years old. And she was real thrilled that she was going to have babies, but when they said twins, well, that was even doubly. But she hemorrhaged to death because she had an abnormal pregnancy. And at that time, my mother asked the doctor who was in charge that she would appreciate if he could bring in a specialist to check my sister's condition, because she said it's not normal. She's swollen face, legs, and arm. For a petite gal, she was kind of blown up. And he had at that time said, as long as he is a head surgeon and doctor, no outsider will be coming in. So when she died, and we were all there, the whole family and my uncle and aunt, my mother, who's a quiet woman who never says anything, pulled the doctor aside and said, doctor, if you had called an outside specialist, I would have accepted this death, but you didn't. And she said, I hold you responsible for her death. And he apologized. But eventually, my mother got over it. You know, it's pretty hard for a mother to get rid, you know, lose an oldest daughter. But she got over it. But she did not bury my sister and the babies there. She kept the ashes. The Buddhist church kept the ashes. And as soon as when we left, she brought the ashes, and they're buried in the Evergreen Cemetery.
I mentioned there were maybe a dozen or so people buried mm-hmm. there. But
yeah, there are.
Why was it important that your sister and the babies not be buried there?
My mother must have had some kind of inkling. She says, no, I want them with me. She didn't. You know, remember, my sister was married, but she didn't even consider the husband. She said, I'm keeping my babies. And so, which was very good because her husband got married again and moved to Chicago, lived there, and we weren't very happy with him anyway. But she must have had a hindsight or whatever. She felt she didn't want to bury them there.
I want to point out that it wasn't just Japanese in these camps. Some Germans, Italians, and Jews were also kept in separate Department of Justice internment camps for fear that they were enemies. Some historians said fear, especially in California, was near hysteria. And I wondered, Rosie, what did you experience? Was it after Pearl Harbor? Was it hysteria? Were people just, what did they think when they saw you or other Japanese Americans?
Well, the Chinese, they had a pin, I am Chinese. And so naturally we didn't have that I am Chinese. We don't broadcast I am Japanese. Anyway, so they knew the Chinese from Japanese. But my Chinese friends, later on after the war, we got together. But they said they also were picked on because people thought they were Japanese. But at that time, we didn't go anywhere. We just stayed within our area because we didn't know. We were scared. I don't know. We didn't know how they were going to react. But when you read about what they were doing to some of the Japanese people, stoning them and hurting them and beating them up, well, we didn't want any part of that. So we just stayed within our little area. But at Roosevelt High School in East Los Angeles, the principal, found out that some of the students were being taken out of classes because they were already being removed, he called a big assembly into the big football stadium. He went the whole faculty, student body, and announced. and that this terrible situation with our students here. And he says, we don't know what's happening, but if anything should happen, say that they have to leave, you're welcome to leave. But he said to the Americans of Japanese ancestry, us, you stay as long as you can in school, and if you need any help, we're here to help you. And that, I mean, for a principal at that time to do such a thing just was very heartwarming to us Japanese Americans.
And something that probably took some courage for him to do.
Absolutely.
Taiko Iratani, same question to you. I wondered what kind of hysteria did you experience? What kind of prejudice did you experience?
Our situation was different because we lived outside of town, and we were under that 5-mile curfew, you know, not going away from your home more than 5 miles, or you had to be at home from dusk to dawn. And so, and of course, we didn't travel back into town for church at all. After that, we were told to stay in our area, and we rode the bus to school. So other than our own classmates, we didn't see anybody else. So it was very simple living for a while there, for me anyway. And the only thing I remember of that time, the one question I was asked by a girl in my class who had been with me since first grade, she says, why did you bomb Pearl Harbor? And here I am, 12 years old. Of course I didn't bomb Pearl Harbor. So that's all one could say. And otherwise, there was very little pressure put on me. I know other people in other areas, especially the populated areas, they had more problems than we did.
So you had it a little bit easier, though that is an odd question to get it at the age of 12. Today we're talking about Executive Order 9066. That is a piece of paper signed 70 years ago by FDR that sent more than 100,000 people of Japanese ancestry to internment camps. Now, we've already heard the story from two women when they were young, teenagers, sent to those camps. I'd like to turn now to Arthur Nishimoto. He's a retired colonel with the U.S. Army. But when Arthur was 18, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and he decided to join the other Hawaii boys rushing to volunteer for the Army. He fought in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was made up of Japanese-American soldiers and which is still the most decorated regiment in Army history for its size and length of service. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take us back to that day when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. What did you see?
Well, it was early, a beautiful Sunday morning. And I was preparing myself to go to church, and all of a sudden I heard all this roaring of the planes flying over our neighborhood. So I thought, this is unusual. So so I ran out to the front yard and looked up, and what I saw, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was Japanese airplanes. The reason why I knew it is because it could see very clearly the round red dot under the wings, and they were coming from all directions, headed toward Pearl Harbor. And so, gee, I just couldn't believe my eyes. So I went up to my garage door and climbed on the roof of my home because they were headed toward Pearl Harbor. So as I look, I stood there for a while, and lo and behold, in a few minutes, I saw the plane just diving down, and the beautiful sun. It was a very beautiful blue sky, calm Sunday morning. Then all of a sudden, these black smokes stopped pouring out. And I said, oh. Then I saw all these planes diving and bombing and bombing. I said, oh, we are being attacked by the Japanese. And so that really awakened me. I was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it.
When did you decide that you wanted to volunteer and to join the United States Army?
Well, it was about a year after. In the meantime, we young men were just a draft age, 18 years old, and knowing that our older brothers, 2-3 years older than we were already drafted, and they were training in the military in the Schofield Barracks, the Army. And so we know that our numbers will be coming up before long. And so we decided, well, maybe we better join the Army. But in the meantime, we were working voluntary workers. As for myself, I was a delivery boy, a messenger boy, because we had a little motorcycle group, a gang, that rode around. So we all went to the RCA radiogram. And, of course, we worked there also, but this is voluntarily afterwards. After work, we were doing delivering messages throughout the city for the government.
And, you know, I wondered, because you were in Hawaii, if it was the same kind of hysteria that maybe Rosie or Tycho experienced. Well, Tycho said it was a little different for her, but what was it like for you after that happened? I mean, it happened right there in Pearl Harbor. How did people look at you? How did people look at all Japanese?
Well, this is a little different. The in Hawaii, the government officials, federal and local government people, including the military, they were forced to, well, they weren't forced, but they were told to evacuate some of us. And our government were opposing Washington. They said, no, these people in Hawaii are good people. We know that. We can trust them. Let's not do anything foolish. And so it's the government that backed us up, really, with all the high, including the Army and Navy and the military top men. And so they wanted us there. So there's nothing wrong with us. We want our local people to be there.
And so you signed up, and you were part of you ended up in the 442nd Regiment.
Yes.
What about when you were in the military and you're now, again, mixed in with all of these other men? How did they treat you? How did, for example, and because it was mostly white men, how did they treat you?
Well, one thing we didn't like at all was being called a Jap.
That was a bad...
That was a bad word for us. Anytime someone called us a Jap, we didn't answer them with words. Our brown fists were in your mouth. That's the way we did. No one called us Jap. And so, as far as the thing that really bothered me was that when we first got in, here we were in uniform, training, and yet we were classified as enemy aliens. Now, does that make sense to you? We are in uniform training in the military, U.S. Army, and we're classified as enemy aliens. Well, that soon was taken off, however, because, you know, that didn't make any sense at all.
And did you know about the internment camps While you were in
yes.
the military?
Yes.
Well, how did you, I mean, here you are, you're wearing a United States
yeah.
uniform. You're fighting for the U.S. against the Japanese of your, this is
yeah.
of your ancestry.
Yeah.
And yet other Japanese Americans are being put into camps.
You see, the difference, why the 442nd is so, shall we say, unified, is because we had two wars to fight. One, the enemy, the Germans or whoever, and one, our own people. So we had two enemies to fight. And we had to prove something. And we really didn't have to, but that's the way it turned out. And so we had two wars to fight. Now, when you get a group of men, 3,000 or 4,000 of us, have the same feeling and knowing what is going on in the United States where they're being put into this, we call it concentration camps, and seeing all this thing going on, well, we have a different spirit in us. We have a different motive. We're all one. And so our feelings, our faith in each other, and our goal were different than maybe an ordinary military unit. That's where I believe we were really strong. And we were brought up that way. Our parents, our Issei parents, were very strict on discipline. And we were well-disciplined. We grew up that way.
I mentioned earlier, the 442nd still the most decorated unit in Army history, again for its size and length of service. It earned 21 medals of honor, only one of which was issued during the war. The other 20 were awarded by President Clinton about 50 years later. But this was a tough group. Its motto was go for broke.
Yes, go for broke. That came from a gambling we call shooting crap, go for broke.
Of all places to come up with a motto for a unit.
Yeah.
What which arena was the 442nd sent to? Was it the European arena?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we started in Italy. Of course, I landed in North Africa, but it's on the way up. But our combat was in Italy. Italy and France, and back to Italy. These are the areas we fought in.
And, because the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, Japan, how did the Italians or the Germans react when they see Japanese soldiers and they were in American uniforms? That must have been a little bit disorienting for them.
Yeah. They call us the little men. They said, wherever we went to, they told us, gee, these are American soldiers, you know, because we weren't that big as the ordinary Caucasians were. However, we were treated well, we're welcome. And I think there was a story going on somewhere. I heard one of the German, during the war, during the combat, one of the Germans got captured, and they said, what are you, you know? Who are you? Oh, he said, didn't Hitler tell you yet that we Japanese switched sides and now we're fighting for the Americans? The difference that I see is that we were unified. We had two main goals, like I said before. And so we had a little different spirit in fighting, I guess.
And I wondered, and Rosie, let me come back to you and also Tycho. When did you find out that there were Japanese Americans fighting for the U.S. And what did you think about that?
We did get news through the newspaper, or we have our newspaper in camp, and they always wrote about what was happening in France and Italy and how these 442nd, 100 team, what they were doing. And we did have a couple of friends whose family, they told us that died in one of those campaigns. But you know, Arthur, my husband was saying he was in the army too, but he was in Camp Shelby and Camp Snelling. Yeah. But he mentioned that the Hawaiians that were in the army, they did not like the Niseis. Somehow they felt that Niseis, well, of course, they didn't talk the same way. Until, I think that Senator Inouye mentioned that until a couple of them went into one of our camps and saw what was happening to the parents of the fighting men, their minds changed, and all of a sudden they got together and got along. But I thought that was a nice story.
That's true.
Yeah.
The reason why, you see, the Hawaiian boys have their own language.
Yeah.
And the American Niseis in the mainland, they have their own language, but they're correct. But we don't. We just when we hear the mainland Japanese American speak, it sounded to us like a little offish, you know. But it's not. That's the way they speak because that's the way you're raised.
It was different languages.
Yeah,
pidgin English.
No, they spoke good English and we spoke pidgin language. Pidgin English. Okay. But anyway, that's what. But we understood what you said is true. Some of the boys went over to the camp, and when they went, and they saw what was happening,
that
changed their mind. Oh, that was a rude awakening for the boys, and they came back and told us what was going on. Yes.
Arthur, did you ever question what you were doing when you knew about the camps, when you found out about the camps?
Yes, I had a question. Why? Why go through all these terrible things that the West Coast Japanese Americans were going through? And I think I know the reason why. It was the government, military officials over there, as well as the government officials. They panicked. They were just panicking.
But then you see all this. You see what the government is doing to this group of people, and yet you're fighting for that government. Did you ever question your loyalty to that government?
No, we didn't question the government, but we did question some of the leadership on the West Coast, not the government.
And what about the president who signed that document? Did you ever question FDR for what he did?
No, I didn't question because he was actually, because of the circumstances, I believe he had to, almost.
And I'm wondering why.
Because of the West Coast leadership, the government leadership, including the military, were very, very, shall I say, forceful in pushing this. The people, there was a couple of generals over there that pushed it real hard.
They went more. They went overboard.
Oh yeah, they said they couldn't trust. They couldn't trust the Japanese Americans there, even though they are born and raised in the United States. His remark was something like this: A Jap is a Jap, whether second, third, or fourth generation. A Jap is a Jap, and that went on, even came up toward the Idaho or Utah in that area. That's how much the.
As a soldier, as a man, you personally, did you ever question what you were fighting for? When you saw those camps, again, you're fighting for the American flag, for the United States, but did you ever doubt or question that loyalty?
No, never did. they questioned our loyalty to the country.
Did you question the morality of it? Again, considering what they were doing.
What they were doing? Yes, I questioned it. I thought that was totally wrong, what they did. What they did was wrong. In fact, I was really surprised that many of the men that replaced our unit, that came as a replacement, came from these camps. I had several men that came to me. I said, which camp, relocation camp did you come from? So and so. I said, how are they doing? Well, you know. I said, what'd you come out for? He says, I'm still American.
And why would men want to fight and protect a government that had put them in camps? You didn't go to one of those camps, but why would these men who were in camps, why would they fight for that country?
They want to prove their loyalty. Simple as that. They're born here. This is the only country they know. They're born here, and they want to prove their loyalty because the government didn't trust them at first. So that's why they just want to prove to them that we're loyal American citizens like anybody else.
We're talking about the 70th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. Basically, when we sent more than 100,000 people of Japanese ancestry into war relocation camps. We've heard stories, personal stories, from women who were there as teenagers, and we also heard stories from a man who, of Japanese descent, fought for the Americans, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. I want to turn back over to Rosie and to Taiko. Rosie, I'm going to start with you. You returned to Manzanar in 2006. What was that like?
Oh, well, I've been there before, I thought I'd let you know. This year, April, the last Saturday in April, they have the pilgrimage to Manzanar, and I think this year is going to be really extraordinary because they have Day of Remembrance, remembering Executive Order 9066 70 years ago, plus they're going to have a speaker, and I think this program, if anyone, they should try to attend that. It's the last Saturday in April. And they have a nice program, and Elisa probably could tell you more. But I think that is one program that everyone should try to make.
But so you had been there before?
I've been there before. Well, one time, Ralph Lazo, who's Mexican-American, he was in our class, and that's why our class was so unique, is we had Ralph Lazo. He was a Mexican-American, I think one-eighth Irish, I think he said. But he came into our camp because he found out his Japanese friends were going to be put into camp. And so he decided he's going to join us, which he did.
It was his way to protest.
And he told his father, he says, Dad, I'm going to camp with my friends. Dad says, good, have a good time, thinking it was summer vacation. Well, the sister said they didn't know about it until they saw it in the LA Times that this Mexican-American youngster went to Manzanar with his friends. They asked, how did you get in there? You're Mexican. He said, well, this is the beauty of having a dark skin. They didn't know what we were. Anyway, we went to Manzanar, Ralph Lazo and our group, and amazing how he spoke on behalf of us Japanese and told these people, especially there were a lot of students from UCLA and maybe 3-4 busloads, and he explained to them how strong and faithful and loyal these kids are that were put into camp. Anyway, he was terrific. I wish you had known him.
I want to finish up on this note, and this one for Rosie, Taiko, and for Arthur. If your great-grandchildren, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren look back on this at the 100-year anniversary, what do you want them to remember, and what do you want them to understand about what you went through and what you experienced? Taiko Uritani, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I have always talked about this experience for many, many years. I guess, 40 years I've talked about it. But I want people to know, and that's why on my coming up trip to New Hampshire and North Carolina, where my daughters are, I'll be talking to classes, university classes. One will be at the New Hampshire Law School, and one will be at the University of North Carolina. And I want to share my experience so it will not be repeated with any group of people, because the government was able to move us into these camps so very easily. We have to prevent it.
And Rosie, same question to you. What do you hope that your grandchildren and great-grandchildren will think about when they think about what happened to you?
They really don't know yet. I have four great-grandchildren. But I want to teach them and put into their brains that, to me, ignorance breeds prejudice. And I want them to keep asking questions and keep learning that we're all the same, even though we may look different. But we're all the same, and we have to treat each other and respect each other. And I'm hoping that, see, all my children are maybe the one-fourth, one-half Japanese, and I want to keep the heritage there. But I just want them to learn and appreciate America, really.
And Arthur, that's the other thing, too. Do you think we have learned that we would never do anything like this again?
If we teach our children that this country, the United States of America, is the only country in the world that gives human beings their free agency, we have to instill in them that no matter what, we got to keep this country. You're born here, you're raised here, and you must fight for it. It's not going to be easy. It's not an easy task. As we know today, the world, many of the countries today, are beginning to realize that the people do not have their own free agency. And therefore, they're fighting. That's the reason why there are all the problems are arising now throughout the world. But this country is a special country. I feel that this is country was established by the Almighty, an example to the world that this is the way we should be living as human beings. And all my grandchildren and great-grandchildren, I have 26 of them. And so I think it's our duty to teach them how precious it is to be living in this great country.
I want to thank our guest, Colonel Arthur Nishimoto. He was with the 442nd Regiment in World War II, a regiment made up of mostly Japanese soldiers, Japanese-American soldiers, and which is still the most decorated regiment in Army history for its size and length of service. Also, I want to thank Taiko Iratani and Rosie Kakuuchi, both women who were teenagers when they were taken into war relocation camps. And also, we heard from Alisa Lynch, the Chief of Interpretation at the Manzanar Historic Site. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again so much for sharing your stories with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining our program. Our producers are Irene Noguchi and Lee Hernandez. Our technical director is Rich Copeland. Ian Milchrist is senior producer of this program. And the news director of Nevada Public Radio is Adam Burke. You can continue the conversation from today's program by going to knprtalk.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for joining us today for KNPR State of Nevada.